You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour with Ruth Reyes, Alan Alder and myself, Matt Bentman. Thanks to Chris and Jordan for the Record Store Day news, and for the next hour, we will be bringing you Cambridge's food and drink news and a host of features.
We've lots of news about the forthcoming Eat Cambridge Festival today to help you plan what events you'd like to go to. Tristram Stewart talking about food waste. We've wine and food at the Cambridge Wine Merchants. An afternoon tea with gourmandise. Oh, and a 40s pop-up cafe. All sorts.
Away from Eat Cambridge, we speak with Cambridge brewery Calverley's, who have some very well-designed beers on the way. Rosie Sykes speaks with Tyler Cotton, who runs a biodynamic farm in Barton. He grows interesting and unusual produce. And on the subject of growing, Dave Fox will be advising on growing plants in a way that means that you won't need to spray pesticides or other chemicals on them.
And on the subject of eating them, Nazima Pathan of Franglais Kitchen will be giving us some ideas on cooking asparagus. At the end of the programme, we'll have all of Cambridge's food and drink news too.
So, lots to look forward to today, and don't forget we are live here in the studio in Guider Street, and we'll be keeping a lookout for any interesting foodie tweets that you can send our way. You can contact us at Flavour105 or text us 07919 070 490.
Let's get straight to the food. As part of Eat Cambridge, the Garden Cafe in Mill Road is putting on a 40s-style pop-up. Matt went along in his best brogues to find out all about it.
It is 5 years and more since Hitler marched into Poland. Now the war against Germany is won.
We'll meet again.
Hello, my name is Laura and I'm the event coordinator for the pop-up on Sunday the 10th of May, which is called We'll Eat Again, which is a 1940s pop-up cafe. So the idea is that it's 70 years since the end of World War II.
Advance Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the king!
And we are looking to kind of recreate some of that community spirit through some typical 1940s dishes. You can expect things like spam fritters, cold meat pasties and doorstop sandwiches and from the garden kitchen. We are also doing this to raise money for the Alzheimer's Society, which is a charity very close to Andrew and I's hearts. Andrew is the owner of the garden kitchen who I'm working with on this project.
That's Andrew Smith, who also runs the cafe at the Botanical Gardens.
Yes, that's right. And this is kind of fitting very well with the Cambridge Eat Festival, obviously the 70-year celebration of the end of World War II. And so, yeah, we've just gone forward with this idea. And so far, we've had some brilliant feedback. Everyone seems very excited about it. Personally, I'm looking forward to trying all the food that Andrew has come up with, like the menu that he's created. So we'll be all dressed up in our 1940s garb. We've got some classic tunes being pumped out. We're going to decorate the cafe as well. So hopefully we'll have some of that real 1940s vibe going on.
Have you sampled any of the food yourself yet, or will it be all on the day?
I'm hoping to persuade Andrew to have like a bit of a practice run any. So, yeah, I would quite like to taste the menu beforehand. Yeah, we're looking at doing a lot of old family favourites, but something that's available to take away. So you can come in, collect your rationed lunchbox, and then take it away to a park or something so you don't have to be in the cafe to enjoy it as well.
Rationing will give everyone, rich and poor alike, an equal share of all that's going. When you get your book, you should register with your shopkeeper for supplies.
There's going to be lots of foods from that era that are acceptable. I know it's a cafe, but at the same time, I have running through my mind images of the other types of food that people used to eat. Brains, faggots. Would that even be supplied?
No. We were trying to appeal to as many people as possible. We are really kind of aiming for the dig for victory type of theme. So it'll be a lot of vegetable based, and obviously being at the garden kitchen, we're going to be encompassing what Andrew would normally be providing in the cafe as well. So there'll be lots of fresh salads and vegetables and hearty, wholesome, nutritious food to enjoy.
Stringent rationing has allowed every civilian in Britain one and tuppence worth of meat once each week, right through the war years.
And no rationing.
There will be a ration. So the idea is we will be providing ration lunch boxes, and you will have a choice of Spam fritters or a meat pasty or a vegetarian dish, and then you have a choice of potatoes. So it'd be either mashed potato, potato salad, or salads or vegetables, and you are only allowed a certain amount of food within your rationing box. So there will be rations, and we're going to try and stick to rationing guidelines as much as possible to keep it authentic.
The only two things which it is now necessary to ration are bacon, which includes ham, and butter.
I do enjoy butter and sugar and those kind of treats, and it's going to be very difficult to try and make something really tasty and appealing with the rations that were available in the 1940s, but we're going to try our best.
Okay, thank you very much, Laura. And just to repeat, this is at the Garden Kitchen on Mill Road. The event is called We'll Eat Again, and it will be taking place on Sunday the 10th of May, free entry.
Absolutely, yes. So if you've got friends and family, we'll be open from 10 o'clock until the food runs out.
Lovely, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, that sounds really good fun. Rosie Sykes has been to a biodynamic farm in Barton where she met Tyler Cotton. Biodynamics uses some of the techniques that organic farming does to eliminate the need for synthesised pesticides and other agrochemicals. But what makes biodynamic growing different is sowing or planting in accordance with the cycles of the moon. And there's also a technique by which a preparation rich in humus is put into cow's horns and buried in the ground to make a soil activator and enlivener, which is then added to the fields. And when she spoke with him, Rosie learned that Tyler's interest in organics developed while he was working on an organic farm in New Zealand. And he then went on to Australia, where he worked on a biodynamic farm for 18 months. He now has 3 acres on Burwash Manor Farm and is growing some pretty interesting crops. The farm had been organic for some years, so not a lot had to be done by Tyler to get biodynamic accreditation, and this year's planting is underway.
I just collected some seedlings from Delphland Nurseries in Doddington. They are organic, they raise organically certified seedlings. I try to sow as much stuff as I can directly from seed, but then I also get quite a lot of stuff as seedlings. I don't really have, you know, the time at the moment or the resources or necessarily the knowledge and experience to be raising all of my own seedlings, so it makes life a lot easier if I can have someone else do that for me.
And what are you about to pop into the ground then?
My first lot of stuff that I've just picked up yesterday, rainbow chard, spinach, and also lots of lettuce. I've got 7 different types of lettuce which I use as a cut and come again, which makes my salad mix, and then I've got 1 or 2 other varieties which I pick as a whole lettuce, cos lettuce, and then I'm giving iceberg lettuce a bit of a try this year.
So when will we start to see that, do you hope? When will that be coming up?
Weather depending, of course. I'm hoping 4 or 5 weeks for the first bit of salad mix, a little bit longer perhaps for the rainbow chard and the spinach.
It's pretty quick though, isn't it?
It's quite quick, yeah. The lettuce I will cover over with polythene, over polythene hoops, just to protect it from any frost that we might have.
Give me a quick rundown on what else you're hoping to plant this year, so what we might see later in the year.
So I'm going to be doing more of the stuff that I just mentioned. Salad mix is my main one, but I'm trying to grow a few curious varieties of things. So I'm doing 6 different types of courgette, round ones, yellow ones, striped ones, and heavily ribbed ones. The heavily ribbed ones, I grow them mainly for the flowers because they have particularly nice flowers, and they're popular with the restaurants.
I was going to ask you about flowers. So you grow some just for flowers, which you...
Yeah, I'll still pick the actual courgette, but I'll also pick the flower as well. And the flowers on the other plants, I'll probably leave them because they're not as nice as the ones on this particular variety. Round ones, striped ones, ribbed ones. And then I've also got three or four different types of dwarf French bean, purple, green. I'm hoping to do some yellow ones as well, and some bolotto beans, which normally people grow bolotto beans to grow them on for the actual beans, which most people will be familiar with in the tins that you get at the supermarket. But if you actually pick them as an early pod, they're just really, really tasty.
Oh gosh.
They're like almost like a flat bean, and they're green with kind of red marbling going through the pod.
I love the fresh actual beans themselves are amazing. So yeah. I'd be interested to try them as a pod, though. I've never tried them like
that. I'm particularly proud of those ones. I grew them last year and they were so tasty that I'm really eager to grow more of those this year. So
I've had spring onions from you, which have been absolutely wonderful. I hope you're growing some of those this year, are you?
Definitely be growing some spring onions. I'll also, some other things to mention would be crystal lemon cucumbers, which I'm hoping to grow. They are a round yellow cucumber that I can grow outside. I'm also a member of the Garden Organic Heritage Seed Library, and I've been allocated some heritage seed from them, which I'm hoping to raise some of those. One or two of those varieties are interesting. Tomato, buffalo horn tomato, which is in the shape of a buffalo horn.
Amazing. Yeah. Wow. So what sort of quantity would you be given of those kind of seeds?
Not much at all. So I think I've maybe got 20 or 30 of an interesting type of cucumber, the buffalo tomato, something similar. So not much at all. Yeah.
That's very exciting, though, and it's such a great thing. Do you have to then send them back any seed or no?
No, you don't have to. Ways of being someone to help increase the supply of those. It's something that I would perhaps like to do later on down the road once I've got things under control up at my field, is to raise some stuff for seed, you know, heritage variety things. I think that's quite important to have some of those. Some of the modern varieties are obviously very good, you know, and there's certainly a place for them, heavy cropping, disease resistance and all that kind of thing. But then also heritage varieties are so interesting and tasty, and some of them are quite disease resistant as well, others not so. But it's good to try and keep the variety going.
Absolutely, you know? And it's the flavour. I mean, a lot of people say, and that's certainly one thing with biodynamics, is people are always blown away by the flavour. So it's very, very interesting. And Tyler, where might we be able to buy some of your wonderful produce?
Well, the main place that I sell my stuff is to the Cambridge Organic Food Company for their vegetable box schemes. So if you wanted to get my stuff, you'd have a very good chance of getting it through them. I also sell it at the larder at Burwash Manor that's owned by Mike, who rents me my field very kindly. So that's the first place, really, that you can go into a shop and pick it up.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Tyler. It's been great to talk to you, and good luck with your summer of cultivation.
Thank you very much.
That was Tyler Cotton speaking with Rosie Sykes.
Yes, and just a reminder, you can buy Tyler's produce from the larder at Burwash Manor or come across it through COFCO's Veggie Box scheme. That's the Cambridge Organic Food Company. Some interesting sounding things.
Yeah, the buffalo horn tomato sounds really cool.
Oh, it does.
Now, later in the programme, Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments will be talking about growing your own food without the need for pesticides. We also have more from Eat Cambridge, including Tristram Stewart's session and what's on at the Cambridge Wine Merchants. And we'll be popping along into Calverley's Brewery, as well as getting some ideas for how to cook asparagus.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
Back to the Eat Cambridge Food and Drink Festival now. Corinne Payet, better known as Gourmandise, is a 3-star Good Food Award winner. She will be at the Eat Cambridge again this year, both at the main event in the Corn Exchange and with her own fringe event, High Tea a la Marie Antoinette, on May 16th at the Geographer in Histon. Here she is telling us a bit about it.
I'll be organising High Tea à la Marie Antoinette, and the event is actually organised by myself and Caroline at the Geographer, this lovely cafe deli in Histon. Basically, the theme is Marie Antoinette, because Marie Antoinette's pâtisserie would probably not be what the pâtisserie is today without the influence of Marie Antoinette. She was a great lover of food and sweets. That's what we want to talk about and bring into the event, basically.
What can we expect in it?
So basically there'll be a quai royal. A quai royal basically is champagne with a crème de cassis. So that's how we will welcome our guests. There will be sweet treats, so a mixture of lovely sandwiches, including salmon's one and some mini quiche. And these will be made not by me, actually, but by Caroline, who's the owner of the Geographer, and she's a fantastic cook. And I'll be looking after the treats. So the treats expect things like éclair, mini gâteau, macaron, because macarons were basically one of Marie Antoinette's favorite desserts. Tarte sucrée, we call them tarte sucrée in France. Basically, they're sweet little mini tarts. So expect things like that. And me being Creole, expect exotic flavors. So there will be things like mango. I think you say lychee? Yeah. So expect exotic flavors. I mean, I don't want to say too much, because I've got a few surprises there, basically. And one of the key things of the part of the event is I will be demonstrating how to make your dessert a little bit more, let's say, posh. Add this, how do you say it in English? You like using this little word, je ne sais quoi, which is very French, or va-va-voom, yes. So how to va-va-voom your dessert. So there'll be a 15-minute demonstration showing you how to do that. Just basically really want to show people that you can make your dessert look smarter and much more beautiful in a very, very simple way, using very simple ingredients. So there will be things that everybody has in their cupboards, basically. And so I just really want to show people that it's not that difficult to add the little French touch. So the event is taking place on the Saturday, 16th of May, and it starts at 4 o'clock and finishes at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, so right bang into the afternoon tea time, basically. And it's taking place at the Geographer in Histon.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much.
So here we go.
As she said, tickets are £25 and you can book through Eat Cambridge or the Geographer in Station Road, Impington, near Histon. It's on the 16th of May, so book quickly. I'm sure those tickets will fly.
Starting to appear on market stalls now is this year's British asparagus crop. Here's Nazima Pathan from Frongley Kitchen with some great ideas for how to use it.
Nazima, one of the things that's coming into season at the moment is asparagus, and I'm very glad to see it coming back into season. There are different types of asparagus, though, I think, aren't there?
Yeah, we're probably most familiar with the green variety that is grown in this country and is, as you say, going to be in season from May, and therefore good tasting but also slightly more cost-effective, because it is an expensive vegetable because it's labour-intensive to grow. There are different types, however. In France, you'll find purple asparagus, and in some parts of Europe, particularly in Holland and Spain, where it's grown underground, it's a white asparagus. They cut it out as the tips emerge from the soil, and so it has a more delicate flavour. So there's different types of asparagus, but mostly what we see here is the green variety.
Yeah, we do see the white occasionally, but I don't think I've seen the purple very much.
I have seen it, but I have to admit I haven't cooked with it.
And it's, being, I suppose, a vegetable, it's good for us.
It's a green veg. It's good for you. It's full of very rich in fibre, folate, and in vitamins A, C, and again with antioxidants. So lots of good stuff in it. So when you're cooking it, you do want to consider how you do to preserve it. You know, a lot of people will boil asparagus traditionally, but actually, if you were to just steam it, you'll get the same finish, but it might take a little bit longer, but it'll hold its sort of nutrients better.
You say a little bit longer. What sort of length of time?
Well, I think it's tricky to you sort of say, but probably about five or 10 minutes, possibly. You know, you just need to prick it with a fork and see. You obviously don't want to overdo it. One of the things that's really important is to, you know, what you want is to preserve the colour, and the colour will leach out when you cook it, particularly if you boil it. And if you want that bright green colour, the best way to try and do it is, as soon as it comes out from the steamer, to plunge it into cold, ideally ice cold water. And that will stop the cooking process, keep it crisp, but also help it lock in the colour.
Right.
We've also done asparagus in the sous vide, which essentially poaches it, and that keeps the colour very well, because it's a water bath and it's packed into a vacuum bag.
You mentioned it's growing in France, growing it in Belgium, so it's used in other cultures as well.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anything more exotic?
So what's nice about this vegetable is that aside from the traditional uses that we see in this country of preparing it with fish and seafood or with eggs as with soldiers, for example, we can see it used across the world. So from Far East Asia in Vietnam and Korea and Chinese cultures used particularly as a side dish with sesame seeds. I've seen a very nice Korean recipe where they steam it along and then tie it with some steamed prawns into little bundles and use it and serve it with a dipping sauce. It's a nice little canapé in the dipping sauces with the traditional gochujang paste, which is a sort of hot red pepper paste that is relatively easily available from ethnic stores. I've got some from the shop on Mill Road, and they into that you add a little bit of lemon juice or vinegar and some garlic and salt and pepper, and it's just delicious. And it's a really nice idea to sort of add a little bit of spice to it. The kind of flavours that asparagus can go with, as I've mentioned, the sort of egg and seafood, but other things that it can take are things like truffle, obviously garlic and parmesan, as well as balsamic, and also almonds and nuts. So we've done a sort of vegan barbecue idea which on our blog, which is essentially charring asparagus and sweet corn and then getting the sweet corn off the cob and sort of serving it on top of the charred asparagus with some peanuts, roasted peanuts chopped up and some chives. And again, that flavour combination works quite well together and offers something if you've got people who don't want to have meat on a barbecue. It's quite a nice filling and flavourful alternative.
Yeah, I was just thinking the peanuts would probably make it quite filling, wouldn't
they? Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's not going to make you feel like you've got a poor side dish.
Yeah,
if you're not wanting to eat the meat.
And some nice flavours, I think that's a really good idea.
Yeah, so that was worked quite well. But strong flavours will work well.
Is that one on your blog?
It is on the blog, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, well, we'll have to check that one out. Any other tips for asparagus?
Things you can do to try and sort of take a step up from the just steaming it and pairing it alongside your vegetables is in terms of presentation. Obviously, when you are preparing it, you do want to trim off the woody ends, and then you can, for example, if you wanted to make soldiers, one thing you could do is to wrap it in phyllo, brushing that with butter and then sealing it and then baking it so that you've got little phyllo parcels, and the tips can be free, but you can just along the stalks, and that's a nice idea. And it's also very nice in soup. So we've done a sort of miso based broth, which is a Japanese broth, and served it with some udon noodles, some steamed asparagus and shredded cabbage that's been steamed, and it's a very simple and light dish. So again, you know, with the Eastern flavours, it does work very well.
So it's really quite a versatile vegetable, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And because of its flavour, it can work with a lot of strong flavours and work nicely with them. One other thing to mention, the French often will peel it before cooking it, and particularly if they're cooking in risottos, they'll peel it and use the peelings, shavings, to make a stock in which to cook the rice. And they're very much into sort of delicacy flavours, so that removes a bit of edge. Personally, I think that's a bit of a shame because it removes some of the nutrient content, but it does, I guess, slightly reduce the bitter edge in the asparagus.
Yes, it can be bitter, but it's not usually a concern,
no.
Is it?
It's a
bitter is all right.
It is, and it's actually very fashionable. Bitter is one of the food trends for this year, apparently.
Oh, is it? Right.
Yes.
Okay, any other points on
no,
asparagus?
That's
brilliant. Thank you very much.
Great.
Yes, thanks to Nazima Pathan, and you can find her food ideas on her excellent website, frongleykitchen.com. Have you any asparagus this year, Alan or Ruth?
Not yet, no.
No?
No, I'm really looking forward to having it with a Claudia Roden Spanish recipe where you have it with hake.
Mm.
So I've got the hake, I haven't got the asparagus.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Back to Eat Cambridge now. Tristram Stewart is a highly regarded writer on matters such as food waste, and he'll be speaking at the Food and Drink Festival on the 21st of May. His talk will also include presentations by Food Cycle, with accompanying nibbles and refreshments. Alan caught up with Bev Sedley to find out more.
Can you tell me something about what Tristram Stewart is going to be talking about?
Tristram Stewart is a very charismatic speaker and writer on food waste. He's very well known internationally. If you haven't heard his TED talk, do check it out on YouTube. It's really brilliant. But he is going to talk about the whole sort of international picture, the global picture about food waste, because really food waste is a recent scandal. It's not something, I mean, food waste has happened in some countries because people have difficulty in storing food, that kind of thing, or rats get to it. But in our modern age, in sort of Western societies, food waste is caused by affluence and by shipping food all around the world, by us being able to buy too much, seeing all these promotions, buy one, get one free, we buy two, we throw the second one away at home. Because food is getting, people won't believe me when I say this, but for most of us, not if you're in real food poverty, food is really too cheap, and the farmers are feeling that, and we don't value it enough. I mean, when I was brought up in the 1950s, we didn't waste food. It cost too much. We had to be too careful. And I think it's something that's happened in the last three decades. And the food is brought in from everywhere. It's flown in thousands of miles sometimes. It has a massive carbon footprint, which is really damaging the atmosphere. Farming practices to produce more and more and more are damaging the earth. The whole situation has really got out of hand. We are wasting a third of what we eat in this country unnecessarily.
So what's Tristram Stewart going to be talking about? He's going to be talking about that sort of thing.
He's going to talk about what can be done about it. But he is a very engaging speaker. He will talk interestingly about it.
We won't feel hectored.
He's not going to wag his finger. He's just going to say, look, this is what it is. And he'll be extremely engaging. We also have one or two short talks from local food waste organisations like the Wonderful Food Cycle that gets food that would be wasted from supermarkets and other shops on a Friday evening, cooks it up and serves a delicious three-course meal, fresh vegetables and things, for people in the community who live in a socially isolated way or can't afford much food, so they get sort of free meals. And we're also launching our Love Food, Hate Waste campaign, which will be lasting a year. And we're doing, Cambridge Sustainable Food is doing it in conjunction with Cambridge City Council recycling team. So there will be lots of events happening over the next year. Stalls, cookery demonstrations about making the most of food, fun workshops for children and adults. There'll be lots of really enjoyable things. Nobody's going to wag a finger. Nobody's going to say, ooh, you should be doing this, that and the other. It's just about, this is the situation, we can do something about it. It'll be better for our health and our pocket. We'll save money if we do.
Good. Thanks very much.
Yes, thanks to Bev Sedley, who was talking about Tristram Stewart's Eat Cambridge presentation. It's on the 21st of May at St Paul's Church in Hills Road from 7:30 to 9:30. And it's free.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Sponsored by the Gogmagog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
One of the things I like about living in a city is that they're full of interest. There are always things that take you by surprise. For example, Hooper Street off Gwydir Street has long been a food destination because it's where the Backstreet Bistro is. But did you know that a little further down the road is a brewery? It's Calverley's Brewery, and it's run by brothers Sam and Tom. Sam, can you tell me what you're brewing at the moment?
We're brewing our five-hop bitter.
And it's got five different hops in it?
Yes, it does. Cascade, Simcoe, Galaxy, Centennial and Citra.
The Cascade is for the bittering, and the Simcoe and the Galaxy are coming in as the...
For flavour hops. And then we're using Centennial and Citra as late addition
for aroma,
and a slight bit of dry hopping as well, just to get a kind of citrusy aftertaste on it.
Right, so quite a lot of thought must have been put into this. This isn't simple stuff, is it?
I think what happens is you just you get experience from using different hops, and you think, okay, it'd be nice to use that with that, this with that. And that's how the kind of recipes develop, really.
And they work.
Yeah,
people like them.
Yeah, we've been really pleased with the feedback we've got from from the public. And
so where can we go and enjoy your beers?
The Architect is really our brewery tap, and so we've always got our beers on there. We've also got them on all the time at the Plough in Shepworth, various pubs around Cambridge, that any free houses that take them, and you'll find during the summer, even tide pubs, they often have beer festivals where they get permission to stock some, and they tend to go and seek out the local brewers, yeah. Which is great.
Are they available in containers?
We're going to be selling cask beer in, well, anything from 2, 4, 8 to 36 pint containers. But I think I suspect we'll probably be bottling within the next month or so.
Yeah. And when will that be? On Saturday mornings, or?
Yeah, initially we'll look for Saturdays, probably till early afternoon. And I think some of the sort of wilder things will be mainly for the bottle market, or possibly. Small casks out of the brewery, and small events at the brewery, that sort of thing.
So you all can come down and see where it's made, and you know, buy the fresh cask ale straight out and take it home with. I'm really interested in the idea of reusing our waste and things that would otherwise would just have no value turning into value. So, for instance, we often have beer that's left that it's too much to go in the cask. So what I've started doing is learning to make vinegar. And so the idea is that we would then start having our own vinegar. So we want to be able to use either straight the beer, you know, have ale chutney, or having vinegar for pickling. Or the potential is quite wide, but it's really exciting. The waste grain we send up to the allotments up just at the end of Sturton Street. We need to, you know, keep our eye on the beer, but we're really excited about the potential of working with other small producers to create interesting products from these, and working together and making beer that's paired with good food, good chutneys, good cheeses, good bread, you know.
Yeah.
From a discussion with Sam, who is one of the people that runs Curly Cow Cafe, we got talking about our ambition to make unfined beer, which is naturally vegan, and so from that conversation, we've now got a cask ready for their next event.
So if it's unfined beer, it's cloudy then, is it?
It's naturally hazy.
Naturally hazy.
Yeah. That's
and how do people react to naturally hazy beer?
If some people might be surprised to see a beer that isn't clear, because they've, you know, grown up to think that if it's not clear, it's the beer's off. Yeah. But actually, this is just a cultural learning that they've had, and what it is they, you know, finings has been added to the brew, and we're interested in, you know, really reducing down. So you've got your base ingredients, you've got your malt and your hops and your water and your yeast, and then you've got this other, you know, additive, which is the finings, which we're interested in seeing if it's possible to do without,
because they're a fish product, aren't they, and therefore not vegan.
Yeah and actually I'm vegetarian myself, and so something that personally I would like to continue that with my drinking habits. And it's the thing that a lot of people are not conscious of, that it's in all their alcohol products, unless it says vegan, it's got this byproduct in. So it's a matter of introducing it to people as something that is actually, it's very tasty, and it's just...
So if it's hazy, or perhaps people would use the word cloudy, it's not going to give you a headache or anything like that. There's nothing to be wary of.
No, although I suppose I think the yeast has a bit of kind of vitamin B, which actually can reduce the headache.
So you drink it for your health.
But though we have been working how to drop the beer, which is so you don't. That's what the findings does. It drops drops all the sediments down to the bottom. Mm. And there's actually ways of doing this using temperature, dropping the temperature.
One thing that was important to us was how it tasted. So we have done some batches where we've done, so from the same batch we've done some unfined and some fined, and we did agree that the unfined tasted better.
Yeah, far better.
Because there's a certain amount of flavour just can be pulled out of it.
Well, does it taste more yeasty?
Not
No, it's
more hoppy.
Yeah, it can be a bit more hoppy. Just generally a lot more character.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I shall look forward to it.
Perhaps we should have a tasting event here and do unfined versus fined and do some blind tasting and see what people think.
Well, let us know if you do. And what led you to start up this enterprise?
I was travelling with my now wife, Gemma, and we were just, I think, were we in Australia or something? And I decided I wanted to start a brewery. You know, years went on where I was brewing at home and just, you know, learning more and more about it, brewing sometimes twice a week to perfect recipes and, you know, tweak and go back and tweak. Quite a good few years of home brewing.
Mm.
But that's, well, the great thing is about, if you're wanting to actually go into brewing, it's exactly the same process brewing 40 pints as it is 4,000. It also takes about the same amount of time as well, strangely. But so you can really master your sort of skills at home. The biggest change really is the fact that the cleaning on a different scale, and how to manage the cask filling and that's. But otherwise, it's a very similar process.
And how long has the brewery been going?
It's just over a year now.
Right.
We kind of launched a bit quicker than I'd hoped. But I had invited the local Canberra branch down to kind of get some feedback. I didn't want to necessarily launch, and you know, they put the thing on the Facebook page and saying about the new brewery and. 2 hours later, there's people calling up, ordering, and it just kind of rolled from there. And they came around and tasted it and said, "Yeah, it's really, you know, lovely. Really like the best bitter. That was our first beer." And then we got going. That was it.
Well, I think they've got some great plans, and we'll be definitely letting you know what they're up to in future. That was Sam and Tom Calverley of Calverley's Brewery.
Now, there's another Eat Cambridge Fringe event that's happening soon. I met with wine advisor Alice Archer of the Cambridge Wine Merchants. I said, "Alice, could you tell me a little bit about what you've got going on?" And she said...
Of course. So here at Cambridge Wine Merchants on Cherry Hinton Road, during Eat Cambridge on the 9th to the 23rd of May, collaborating with Food Park and various street food vans around Cambridge, we'll be having a number of different vans popping up, matching some exciting wines to them, having little drop-in tastings, trying some new wine with some new food, seeing how it goes.
And people can drop in any time? There's no booking necessary?
Yep, no tickets required, no booking. Do feel free to call us and reserve a table, but it's just drop in, have some good food, have some good wine. We're also really looking forward to Siesta Fiesta on Sunday the 17th of May up at Childley Hall. We'll be involved particularly in educating people about sherry, Rioja, New Wave Spanish wine. There'll also be a great number of food vans there. Gorilla Kitchen's certainly going to be there. We'll be having a gin palace. Lots of fun. Hopefully the sun will be out.
Can I ask a side question? Any particular reason why you've chosen sherry?
Because everyone needs to know about sherry. We are focusing on sherry because May is the time when there is a large festival going on in Jerez, and so we're trying to go along that theme. So you'll be able to try and learn about everything from the driest manzanilla from Sanlúcar de Barrameda up to the sweetest of Pedro Jimenez varieties from Jerez and Santa Maria.
Cheers, or as they say in Spain, cheers.
So every Thursday evening, we have the Steak and Honor van parking up outside our shop. We also regularly work with Jalan Jalan and Gorilla Kitchen. People come along, buy your burgers, buy your food, come in and seat in our new expanded bar area in the back of the shop. Come and try some wine, buy by the glass if you like, have a G&T, drink what you like, eat what you like.
So
Soupy twist.
Soupy twist.
And educate the world about sherry, because it's a great drink and more people need to know about it.
That was Alice Archer of the Cambridge Wine Merchants mixing it up with Food Park, matching their wines to a plethora of street food vans and their own recently expanded dining area. It's all ideally timed to eat Cambridge and the onset of the Mediterranean heatwave that we're supposed to be getting. Well, fingers crossed.
One of the talks and discussions at Eat Cambridge is about where our food comes from and how the choices we make can help develop a fairer and more sustainable food system. Transitions Cambridge is an organisation focused on getting people to live a sustainable lifestyle, and their event at the Box Cafe will focus on how we change our attitude towards food and leftovers. I spoke with Anne Mitchell about it.
It's a talk organised by Transition Cambridge. And Transition Cambridge is a group which is committed to a more sustainable lifestyle. My particular interest is food and the food system, the global food system, and where our food comes from and how it's produced. So the food talk I'm going to do is about, it's called What's for Tea Tonight? And it's looking at the choices that we make in terms of what we buy at the supermarket or the shops or the markets, how we can make better choices to encourage eating more seasonally so we don't have the air-freighted food shipped in from all around the world at all times. And I think we value our food if it's more seasonal. There's nothing better than strawberries in season grown down the road. Rather than ones grown in California in January and shipped across to us. They don't taste the same. And the same with cucumbers and tomatoes. If we have them in season in the summer here, they're so much tastier. And to look at is the sort of foods which we buy regularly. And we're going to have a practical quiz session. Look at some menus and have a discussion about the elements in them, where they come from, which ones are more environmentally friendly, which ones are healthier for us. And then we're going to have a challenge for ourselves to look at food waste and what we can do with some leftovers creatively. So we have a little competition at the end, creative use of our leftovers. So that's a summary of what the talk's about. It's at the Box Cafe because that's a very nice space. We've got it to ourselves, so there won't be a lot of fuss and bustle. We can sit around the tables informally, have a talk, have a nice drink while we're having the meeting as well, and hopefully come away feeling enthusiastic about making good choices in our food.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Anne. It's lovely chatting to you. It sounds like a really fun event with some very good ideas. No need to book, just show up. That's on Thursday, May 14th, 7:30 until 9 p.m.
We heard earlier Rosie Sykes speaking with Tyler Cotton about growing food in ways that don't require artificial chemicals such as pesticides. And those of us that grow small quantities of fruit and veg can use the idea of companion planting to help keep plants free from insects. Growing carrots and onions together, for example, the idea is that the smell of the onions hides the smell of the carrots, so carrot root fly isn't attracted. On a lovely warm but windy Wednesday this week, I spoke with Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments about companion planting.
There's lots of recommended pairings if you go online or look at a really good website like Garden Organic. You'll find lots of recommendations, but it's also fun to experiment. And certainly that one with onions to protect the carrots is a popular one, and some people say it works. I'm a little bit cynical about that one, because my carrots often get the fly, even though I've planted onions next to them. But and with so much in gardening, it's a percentage game. You know,
reducing the chance.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you just by choosing to grow certain things near each other, you're giving yourself a slightly better chance of getting a good pest-free crop. Incidentally, that one can be a mutually beneficial relationship, because my crops have never suffered onion fly, but there is a suggestion that the smell of the carrots might deter the onion fly as well. So that's a good example.
And what other examples are there?
Well, one that I use and that certainly works for me is scent masking. So I like to grow tomatoes, and there's a flower, Tagetes. It's like a relative of the French marigold, which is really smelly. I mean, especially in the evening, they give off this amazing aroma. That certainly helps to mask the scent of the tomatoes and deter the black fly that might otherwise come and suck juices out of your succulent tomato plants. So, and the tagetes are attractive flowers as well. So, another idea that we can use on veg plots here is the terrible pest of almost all the brassica crops is the small white, the cabbage white butterfly, whose caterpillars can absolutely can really devastate a crop of brassicas just by eating away all the leaves and just leaving a skeletal plant. Nasturtium flowers. Nasturtiums is a good one to plant around your brassicas because they grow at the same sort of time and they last a long time and they'll keep going until the first frost. So they're in leaf and in flower just at the time when your brassicas are vulnerable and the butterflies are on the wing. And the butterflies will preferentially lay their eggs on the nasturtium.
And nasturtiums themselves are quite desirable in salads, aren't they?
Absolutely.
The flowers, for example.
They certainly are, and the leaves as well. If you like a spicy salad, put a few nasturtium leaves in and some flowers on top to decorate. Yes. So, another type of beneficial relationship between a crop and a companion you might arrange for is physical protection from wind or sun. And I'm thinking here of something like tender salad crops like radishes. In the summer, just when you want salads, radishes will quickly bolt and go woody and not be good for eating when they get, because they'll get hot and dry. But if you plant them, if you sow them in the shade of something like sweet corn, then it's going to be a little bit cooler, a little bit damper underneath or to the north of the sweet corn.
Mm.
And you might get a good crop of radishes even in July and August. But if you found that you were having crop failures after good flowers on your courgettes or summer beans, for example, then it may be that there's not enough pollinators, that you know the flowers are just dying before they get pollinated. Then do something to try and attract the pollinators in. And of course, it's a good time of year to start sowing these annual attractant flowers. Mm. Yet another companion technique would be intersowing. We can actually see that right over here. Here we've got parsnips with radishes marking the row. So at first sight, what we can see here just looks like two rows of radishes, which are about 3 weeks old, and they've got their first and even second set of true leaves. And if I pull a radish. Yeah, there's a okay. Well, there's a bit of a root on there.
Yes,
it's not
yes.
quite big enough for the kitchen, but gaps in the radishes. And here's my parsnip seedlings. The purpose of this is that the parsnips can be a little bit tricky because they're slow to germinate and the seedlings are small and they just don't grow particularly fast. So if you're using a hoe for weed control, it's easy to take out your parsnips by mistake. However, if you've got radishes marking the straight line, and you know the parsnips are in the same line, and you can hoe along.
So you've left gaps between the parsnips, and you've put the radish in the gap.
Right. The parsnips are station sown, so every 6 to 8 centimetres, I've put two or three parsnip seeds, and then I've dropped three or four radish seeds in the row between those.
Right. And then will you need to thin the parsnips?
Absolutely, that's right. Yeah. So
one growing in each station.
Yeah. I mean, here the beneficial relationship is really between the plants and me as the gardener, rather than between the plants themselves. So yeah. So that's called intersowing.
When people grow potatoes and they earth them up, the space between the rows of potatoes, I've never noticed people growing anything there, and yet there's quite a big area.
There is, and that's probably going to be quite fertile and quite moist if you've incorporated lots of organic matter. There'll be shading, but a fast-growing crop like radishes or perhaps even some early turnips. So, yeah, it's always worth having a look to see what little microclimates that there are in your garden and see where you might squeeze something in. One thing you could perhaps do, if there was sufficient spacing between the rows of potatoes, would be to sow your runner beans between the rows of potatoes. And this would have the advantage of providing a moist environment for the beans to germinate and for the seedlings to develop.
and also perhaps give a little bit of frost protection in that critical period, end of May, first week of June, when we might just get a frost. The fact that the potato foliage holds a lot of air close to the ground, warm air close to the ground. Mm. Perhaps we've just discovered something. Shall we?
I think we could give that a go actually.
It's very tempting. I wish I'd got the packet of beans right here to give it a try.
Right, and any other suggestions for companion planting?
Oh yes. you can have communities with more than two plants in the beneficial relationship. The classic one there is it's called the Three Sisters, comprising sweet corn, climbing beans and pumpkin. The sweet corn provides a stout framework which your climbing French beans can climb up, and the pumpkin spreads along the ground, forming a natural mulch. So that's going to conserve moisture, which both the beans and the sweet corn are going to appreciate. And it definitely works. You need to get the timing right. It's sweet corn is a little bit slow to start, and so you don't want the beans shading out your sweet corn seedlings. So it's probably worth, as your sweet corn starts to go, put some French beans in the ground next to the corn, and also have a few seedlings of French beans ready to pop in, just in case those beans don't work out one way or the other. My favourite idea, which is a form of companion planting, is called polyveg, which I was introduced to on a permaculture course here a few years ago. And polyveg is sowing and planting lots of vegetables together all at once, maybe 15 different types. And the result is, you could call it vegetable chaos. Lots of leaf shape, colour, size, texture, smell, all grown together. And from the point of view of a pest trying to find its one or two specific food plants, that's going to be very confusing. And certainly that aspect of polyveg works with very little pest damage. And the tricky part of it is that you want to get the proportions of your different vegetables right in the bed, so that one thing doesn't dominate. The idea is that you can have a succession of harvests from the same bed. One tip is that you do need to compost it well, because you're aiming to get a very high level of production out of a small area here. So you want to feed it in advance. But it's a brilliant idea, and if you think about the advantage that we've already discussed, say of carrots and onions benefiting each other, well, that's one or two benefits if it's a mutually beneficial relationship between two plants. But if you have 15 types of vegetables, there's 120 possible beneficial relationships between those plants. So it scales up quite nicely. Of course, there might be non-beneficial relationships there as well. So plants competing, outgrowing each other.
Yeah.
And that's why getting the proportions of the crop types and the spacing in a polyveg bed is right. So with the small seeds, we'll measure teaspoons out and broadcast it, so we get and try and get a fairly even coverage. But with the larger plants like broad beans or even peas, we will carefully space the seeds into the ground at a much greater spacing than we would if we were growing a monoculture of them.
Mm. And thanks to Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments for that advice. Alan, are you going to try it out at all?
I do a bit already, really. I'm careful what I plant with what, and fingers crossed, I've not had carrot root fly for years, which, rightly or wrongly, I have been putting down to growing my carrots very close to onions.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, sponsored by the Gog Magog Hills Farm Shop, your local award-winning food retailer.
Time for our food and drink news. About to start is the Gog Magog's Great Gog and Green Egg Chili Off, featuring Leo Rietoff of Steak and Honour, Jay Scrimshaw of Guerrilla Kitchen, chili expert Ben Capsicana and Nick Williams, the Big Green expert. It's £10 to taste the chilies and to vote for your favourite. Also present are Moonshine Brewery, offering tastings of their four IPAs, and Jack's Gelato, whose flavours will include chili and mango sorbet. And there are cookery demonstrations too. It sounds like a great afternoon, beginning at 1 p.m. at the Gog Magog Farm Shop.
And also on now, and for the rest of the day, there's a free tasting of 12 Greek wines from Noel Young in Trumpington.
Steak and Honour will be at the Flying Pig in Hills Road tonight from 7. On Thursday, they'll be at the Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road. Very busy this week, so get there early.
And on the subject of burgers, at Butch Annie's in Market Street, there's a free beer with every burger inside this weekend. Maximum one per customer.
Tomorrow, a chance to try Russian apple pastillas at St Giles' Church in Castle Hill. Details are to be found on the camrus.com website. You'll need to book in advance.
Also tomorrow at the Three Horseshoes in Maddingley, a chance to try some longhorn topside from Cottenham, which they'll be roasting, and that sounds great to me.
There's a beer festival at the Mill in Mill Lane. It begins on Monday and lasts until Saturday.
And next Saturday from 9 till 12 is the regular Farmers Market at the Memorial Hall in Great Shelford. That's the week after there's a Farmers Market at Linton Village College. And these are genuine Farmers Markets. So someone involved in the growing or the producing of the food will be on each stall, and the producers will all come from 25 miles away or less.
On the 24th and 25th of April, the Live and Let Live pub in Mawson Road has a rum festival.
Two pieces of news from Bread and Meat in Bennett Street. First, they have a French night coming up. We'll tweet the information when we get it. And second, you can now get food from them delivered to your home or office via Deliveroo, which is worth looking up, very easy to use.
And you can now buy Inda's Kitchen ready meals at Cousins Butchers in Grantchester Street, Newnham.
Jack of Gelato fame has been supplying the ice cream bar at Nord, but now he's taking over the running of it, which should be interesting.
And finally, wannabe homebrewers will be interested in the dedicated homebrew showroom that's opening up in Cutlex and Mill Road next Saturday.
And that brings us to the end of another programme, and we hope you've enjoyed it. It will be repeated tomorrow morning at 7 and podcast soon after.
And remember to follow Flavour on Twitter at Flavour105 to keep up with Cambridge and Eat Cambridge food news.
Coming up this afternoon on Cambridge 105 at 1 o'clock, Neil Whiteside is talking to Felix Morgan and Ben Nunn from Cambridge band The Abstracts. At 2 o'clock, I'm back with Rocklit, a review of Mark Blake's new book about The Who. At 3 o'clock, Cambridge Minds with Trevor Dan, and today Trevor interviews Jim Secord, who, amongst other things, leads the Darwin Project, and that's publishing all of Darwin's letters online. Also on the programme is David Tong, Cambridge's answer to Brian Cox. Then at 4, it's sport, and Jason Allen is here at 6.
But from us here at Flavour, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.